From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. President Bush gave his final State of the Union address last night. He made the case that there's been progress in Iraq and tried to reassure Americans that the economy would recover. With the president's low approval ratings and a dramatic presidential election year overshadowing him, are Americans paying attention to his message? To give us their perspective, we've got Melissa Harris-Lacewell. She's a political science and African-American studies professor at Princeton University. And DeRoy Murdoch, he is a media fellow with the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University. Welcome.
Hi there.
Thanks for having us.
So let's get your responses to the president's State of the Union. Melissa, how did this compare to past addresses by the president?
Well, I mean, in some ways, it didn't have any of the fun things that we progressives like to make fun of, right? No dog whistle politics on the evangelicals. And, you know, for the most part, except for that sort of gleeful first 15 minutes where he slapped Congress around a little bit, it was actually stunningly boring. He didn't use this as an opportunity to really either crow very much about what he believed to be the strength of his presidency, nor to say, you know, really very much about what he imagines his legacy is going to be. Instead, it was, you know, very sort of restrained, you know, saying a little bit about the surge, a little bit about shopping our way out of the mortgage crisis. But for the most part, it just, in this particular election year with so much exciting politics going on, sort of boring.
DeRoy, what do you think?
I thought it was very modest programmatically. I guess this is probably a reflection of the fact that the president understands he's in his eighth of eight years. His is now one voice among many as we've got a wide open Republican and Democratic fields for president. And, of course, the Democrats are running Congress. So rather than come in with a bold and imaginative and innovative a list of innovative agenda items, he came in with a number of, I think, interesting, pleasant, small ideas, such as I think the best one is the idea of this executive order that would limit the ability of the bureaucracy to spend money on earmarks that are not actually in the legislation that Congress votes on, rather than in these sort of little reports the chairman put out. Most of the earmark stuff is in that kind of language, and I think this executive order will stop that. He talked about a $300 million program of Pell Grants for kids, which I assume would be some sort of a small school voucher program. Another good idea I thought was letting veterans who have not used up all their GI Bill education benefits pass that money along to their spouses or their children. Also a good idea, but not exactly anything quite as bold or ambitious as his effort to personalize Social Security or his $100 billion plus tax cut proposals we've seen in the past. So I think he's basically responding to the reality that his party's not in control, that his tenure is winding down, and he could ask for Congress for a lot of things, not get them, or perhaps ask for smaller things and maybe succeed on a smaller scale.
And, of course, the Social Security not being able to advance, tax cuts having advanced. Let's go to a little bit about President Bush talking about the economy. Here's a listen.
As we meet tonight, our economy is undergoing a period of uncertainty. At kitchen tables across our country, there is a concern about our economic future. In the long run, Americans can be confident about our economic growth. But in the short run, we can all see that growth is slowing.
Now, Melissa, we spoke yesterday with economist Julianne Malveaux about whether or not a proposal that in broad strokes was agreed on by the White House and the House of Representatives really did enough for people who were working class, seniors, people who needed extension of unemployment benefits. Well, as it turns out, yesterday the Senate Finance Committee came back with a package that did address some of those issues. And there's now a competition between the White House and the House and then the Senate. How is this going to affect the president's ability to shape the debate over what a stimulus package should look like?
Well, I mean, certainly Julianne Malveaux, as the economist, is very clear-eyed on this. I will say that part of the problem is now we have the Congress and the president fighting to do this stimulus package, which is ultimately little more than, you know, how many different kinds of groups are we going to send to the mall on Saturday? Will it be just the middle class? Will it be the middle class with their grandmothers? The big question is, how are we going to fundamentally address the underlying crisis which we are facing, which has to do with home ownership and the mortgage crisis? There are other very clear-eyed economists who are making very strong suggestions that what needs to happen is a big exogenous shock by the feds, in which the feds will cut rates about half of what they've already done, down to below 2%, at least in the short term, in order to change the kind of impact that these variable interest rates are having on families. And it will do it without, again, undermining the budget that we need to be operating with at the federal level. So, you know, yeah, are they going to fight over this? Sure, but they're doing it because there's some political capital here, not so much because it will save us from the crisis that we're in.
DeRoy, let me frame this in terms of ideology. When people say things like liberal, progressive, conservative, you know, there's so many meanings. And there's the whole question of fiscal conservatism and whether or not President Bush actually lived up to the idea of fiscal conservatism when this government has spent so much money on things ranging from the war to other initiatives. How does a stimulus package fit into an idea of fiscal conservatism? Is this something that's in line with what the administration wants or with what Republicans or conservatives want?
I don't think it fits in very well at all, unfortunately. I find a couple things about the stimulus package kind of puzzling and frustrating as someone who considers himself a fiscal conservative. The first is that the idea is it's supposed to be fairly immediate and temporary to address the concerns people have right now with the housing market and the economy apparently slowing down. If this package were approved this week, I've heard that the rebate checks would start coming out in May. So we're all supposed to sit around here in January and wait 4 more months to be stimulated. I don't know about you, but sitting around waiting 4 months to be stimulated does not sound very appealing to me, number one. And number two, what we really need is not some essentially a Washington, D.C. giving each of us a little gift card or like a gift check, which we can go out and go shopping. We'll go out and buy something nice and pleasant. And within a week or two, what else happens? What we need to do is change immediately the long-term incentives for people to work, save, invest, and produce. And you do that by cutting taxes, by deregulating, by changing the nature of people to say, okay, I will open up a factory, I will hire more people, I will expand my payroll, I will open this new store, I will go produce and market this new product. And you don't do that by giving people checks for $300 or $400 or $500 saying go out and buy something nice or go stick it in the bank. This, to me, does not look that much different from George McGovern's Democrat program of 1972, where if you vote for McGovern and he got in and became president, everybody would get a check, I think it was for $1,000 or something like that. This seems to be kind of the same idea, only pushed by a Republican president and not even as much money as McGovern was pushing himself. So I guess I'd call this program basically McGovern Lite.
Okay. Well, I want to turn to another big topic, the war. In just a few weeks, we're going to mark the 5th anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq. Let's listen to how the president framed things.
Last month, Osama bin Laden released a tape in which he railed against Iraqi tribal leaders who have turned on al-Qaeda and admitted that coalition forces are growing stronger in Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, some may deny the surge is working, but among the terrorists, there is no doubt al-Qaeda is on the run in Iraq, and this enemy will be defeated.
DeRoy, this is definitely going to be one of the biggest issues that the president is evaluated on in terms of legacy. What is he leaving behind? Is he leaving behind al-Qaeda on the run, as he argues, or a country in a war that we can't figure out what to do about?
I think we'll see in the months ahead whether the progress we've seen as a result of the surge, the decrease in violence, the increased political stability, the not full-blown reconciliation among Shiite, Sunnis, and Kurds, but some improvement in that area. If all those things congeal and continue in advance, or if there's backsliding, I think at the moment it looks as if al-Qaeda is on the run in Iraq. Bin Laden just put out a tape a couple weeks ago basically castigating the Sunnis and the Shiites for getting along as well as they are, and the Sunnis for cooperating with the government and so on. And I believe bin Laden's son actually came out and sort of attacked his dad and said, you know, give peace a chance. Now, this wouldn't happen if al-Qaeda were on the move. So I think that they appear to be in retreat, and that's a good thing. I think the surge is a big part of this. And if Iraq can calm down and be stabilized and serve as a model for its neighbors, not Switzerland or Holland for sure, but perhaps a regional Mexico, if you will, that would be a big step over where it was, a huge step over where it was before, which is as a belligerent dictatorship. And if that actually happens, I think it will. History will show that President Bush's policy was indeed a success, despite the bloodshed and the tremendous losses of human life and injury of Americans and certainly people on the ground in Iraq as well.
Melissa, let's throw something else into the mix. The president has taken a harsh stance against Iran, but he didn't address its nuclear ambitions in the speech. He also didn't talk about North Korea. In the big picture, what message does that send about what the U.S. is and isn't willing to do in the final months of the Bush presidency?
Well, I mean, I think part of this has to do with what the U.S. is and is not capable of doing. So many of these things are tied together in these very quirky ways. So the notion of getting support and a standing ovation about what bin Laden is putting out on his tapes is quirky, given that it means bin Laden is still out there making tapes. And if there was one thing against which we should measure a response to 9/11, it should be about the capture of bin Laden, not the capture and hanging of Saddam Hussein. Further, this idea, for example, of the young men who are and young women who are going to give over their benefits to their families because they're not able to use them, part of the reason they're not able to use them is because they're doing 5 tours of duty in Iraq. They don't have time to go to school. So these things which look like kind of the president doing something big or being aggressive or making these sort of largesse are really about his fundamental policy failures. So he's not bringing up these other very serious threats to the U.S., both sort of threats to our understanding of our standing in the world as well as potential military threats, because there really is almost nothing we can do about it from a military perspective. There are diplomatic things, but not military ones.
All right, Melissa DeRoy, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Thanks.
We heard from Melissa Harris-Lacewell. She's a political science and African-American studies professor at Princeton University. Also, DeRoy Murdoch, a media fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and he joined us from New York. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. In a matter of weeks, Kenya has gone from one of the more stable nations on the continent of Africa to a place roiled by political turmoil and murder. 250,000 people have fled their homes. Today, gunmen killed a member of parliament from the opposition party. That party is led by Raila Odinga, who challenged Kenya's president, Moi Kibaki, in recent elections. The government said Odinga lost, but Odinga and his supporters believe the election was stolen. Today's killing triggered new violence in the capital city of Nairobi and elsewhere around the country. All this as former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan opened new talks between President Kibaki and Odinga. Meanwhile, there's fresh fighting in the agriculture-rich towns of the Rift Valley. NPR's Ophebia Quist-Arkton recently reported from the region.
Mobs of youths armed with stones charged the police, who fired into the air to disperse them. 3 more days of violence, and houses in 2 more towns in Kenya went up in flames. The attackers used everything from clubs, machetes, to bows and arrows to set upon residents from other tribes. And there were revenge raids. Some people were locked in their houses, which were set on fire. Others were clubbed or hacked to death. The targets this time were the Rift Valley capital, Nakuru, and nearby Naivasha. Both towns are tourist havens. The Rift is an opposition stronghold, but it's also home to large communities of Kikuyu who belong to the president's tribe. The main stadium in Nakuru was packed with people, again driven from their homes and seeking refuge.
Well, we're in the stadium and the place is actually completely full, especially of women and very young children. They're here with the belongings that they have managed to escape with, sitting literally in a field. Fortunately today, it's not raining. They're trying to cook, but some have complained that they don't even have the wherewithal to be able to cook food. I'm just going to chat to this lady. Ma'am, what's your name, please?
My name is Pamela Rasari.
What's your message to the political leaders now from both sides? Because you know that Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, is trying to mediate in the conflict.
They sit down and talk together and discuss over this issue because of them. Why can't they just sit down and square all these things instead of us down here suffering?
Like Pamela Rasare, many of the displaced are demanding that President Mwai Kibaki and his political rival Raila Odinga sit down and talk to end the mayhem. Former UN Chief Kofi Annan, who's trying to broker peace in the Kenyan conflict, toured the Rift Valley on Saturday. He deplored the violence.
We saw gross and systematic abuse of human rights of fellow citizens, and it is essential that the facts be established and those responsible held to account.
Meanwhile, humanitarian workers who are trying to help tens of thousands of displaced people are even worried about their own safety in Naivasha, which exploded on Sunday. Abbas Gullet is head of the Kenya Red Cross.
This morning I traveled on the road to Naivasha because we are setting up a camp in Naivasha for the last 2 days for people coming into Naivasha. And my staff were this morning quite frightened to say they would go out because there were roadblocks everywhere in Naivasha town and that whole highway.
The police claim to have restored order in the Rift Valley. Provincial Commissioner Hassan Nur Hassan insisted they had the situation under control as he boarded an army helicopter to fly over the region.
The situation is tense in the town here, Nakuru. Things are tense, but I'm sure we'll be able to overcome it. Of course, people have been burning houses and, you know, going for each other's throat, basically on the basis of tribe and all these kind of things. This is part of the post-election violence, and we're not taking it lightly. We've been able to contain the situation in many parts of the province.
Yet that confidence was shattered. About 1,000 people from opposing ethnic groups faced off in Naivasha, in the very Rift Valley the commissioner flew over. It's hard to imagine that the police would be able to keep them apart. Ofer Biakwis-Darkton, NPR News.
And this week on Africa Update, we have more on the political crisis in Kenya. President Bush also has pledged aid to Africa, but is it enough? And France extends an olive branch to Rwanda. For more on all of this, we've got Bill Fletcher. He is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans-Africa Forum. Hi, Bill.
Hey.
So we just heard Ophebia Quist-Arkton's report, very vivid report on the violence in Kenya's Rift Valley area. Can you tell us a bit more about that area, give us some background on the ethnic groups that live there?
Well, as was mentioned on the report, the Kikuyu were moved into the area in the 1960s as part of a settlement policy. And so there's been tensions between the Kikuyu and other tribes that are, quote-unquote, indigenous to the area for quite some time. But I think that what your listeners have to appreciate is that this situation has been simmering for a while. This is, however, not primarily an ethnic conflict. It's a politicization through ethnicity of a conflict. In other words, the basic issue is that there's been longstanding discrimination. There's been a longstanding lack of real democracy in Kenya that's played itself out along ethnic lines. And with the apparent stealing of the election, the country has just begun to unravel. And it's become increasingly serious. I mean, the last time I was on the program, I said that I believe that the Odinga and Kibaki can come to a settlement, but I'm not clear what the long-lasting impact will be for Kenya itself. And I feel that the same way today.
Now, when you mention the Kikuyu, they're the largest group. Are they the ones who've been politically favored in this whole equation over the past decades?
Yes, they have been largely favored. But when Kibaki first came to power, part of why he represented such a broad front was the notion of a true democratization of Kenya, meaning not simply the end of a literal dictatorship, which the country had been suffering, but also the end of favoritism for any particular ethnic group. And the difficulty is that when he took power, he reneged on those promises, which set the stage for the current conflict.
How has Kenya been, what was Kenya's path out of colonialism? I mean, Africa over the past century has been unfolding and unpacking its colonial history. Does any of this have to do with how Kenya emerged from colonialism?
Yes and no. The Kenyans, as people will remember, fought a war against Britain, and it was Britain was the colonizer, and it was the known as the Mau Mau Uprising in the West. The British had originally conceived of turning Kenya into a a settler state along the lines of then Rhodesia or South Africa, but moved away from that. Jomo Kenyatta, the first president of Kenya, was associated with the Mau Mau and was expected by many people to not only be a champion of African liberation, but a champion of a transformation of Africa. However, shortly after taking power, he became a very close ally of the British and the United States and did not undertake any significant steps to transform the long-standing problems of Kenya, land control, issues of distribution of wealth, etc. And so these problems that we're seeing now, you can see their root in the failure to actually embark on a transformational effort in the 1960s.
One of the things that we do on News and Notes is we answer letters, and we recently got a letter about the use of the word tribe. We intend to do a bigger exploration of it, but the whole question from one of our listeners was, is the word tribe or tribal applicable in this case, and why or why not, in terms of talking about the violence and the political factions?
That's a great question, Farai. I usually use the term ethnic group, largely because tribe as a term has been used in European and North American parlance to refer to ethnic groups in places where the people are of color. I mean, that's the reality. Mm. So whether it's Africa or Native Americans in North America or South America, or in fact in Asia. So I think that the term tribe often carries with it a condescending note. We're basically talking about an ethnic conflict, which in many ways is not altogether different than the conflicts that erupted in the former Yugoslavia and tore that country apart.
There are many different nations throughout the continent of Africa that are hubs for commerce, for community building. Kenya has been one of those places. How is it affecting the region that this is going on in Kenya?
Well, Kenya has been blessed with a moderate climate and has been a center for tourism in addition to trade, as you mentioned. And the current situation is absolutely destabilizing the country economically. So it is affecting internal commerce. There's been a great deal of discussion about the impact on the Kenyan so-called middle class, the professional managerial groupings that are becoming very fearful of their futures. But it also discourages any kind of long-term investment into the country itself.
Now, Kenya and the U.S. have had a long-standing relationship, and there are, for example, more Kenyan students studying in the U.S. than students from any other African nation. So what's the tie there? What's the relationship, and why is there such a strong relationship between Kenya and the U.S.?
Well, I think that it goes back to an earlier point, that after independence, Kenya, under the leadership of Jomo Kenyatta, was prepared to submit itself to a neocolonial status under Britain and the United States. And to put it in less inflammatory terms, they became a very close ally of the United States in the Cold War. And they basically followed economic policies that Britain and the United States subscribed to. So there is this longstanding relationship. There was no real attempt by the Kenyan government to take a different path, as we discussed earlier. What's interesting about the current crisis is, as you may remember, right after the election results were announced, the United States was prepared to recognize Kibaki as having been reelected. It was only after growing international protests of the apparent illegality of the election that the United States backed off. But they were prepared to settle for a continuation of Kibaki's rule.
Now, I want to turn to another topic. As we heard earlier in the show, last night the president gave his last State of the Union address. He pledged billions of dollars to combat HIV and AIDS in Africa. Let's take a listen.
America is leading the fight against disease. With your help, we're working to cut by half the number of malaria-related deaths in 15 African nations. And our emergency plan for AIDS relief is treating 1.4 million people. We can bring healing and hope to many more. So I ask you to maintain the principles that have changed behavior and made this program a success, And I call on you to double our initial commitment to fighting HIV/AIDS by approving an additional $30 billion over the next 5 years.
So, Bill, what do you make of the president's remarks?
Every time I hear President Bush talk about billions, I start thinking about Carl Sagan and talking about billions of stars and billions of this. Part of the problem when I listen to and consider what President Bush is talking about is more what he doesn't talk about. That U.S. aid to Africa is significant in terms of dollar amounts that are mentioned, but as a percentage of what the United States does offers internationally, it's actually not all that significant. A couple of years ago, I did a little research on this and discovered that U.S. aid to Africa, if you withdraw Egypt, is less than the aid to Israel. The total aid is less than the aid to one country, a key ally of the United States. So that figure told me a little bit about the priorities of the United States. The second thing is that there are regularly strings attached to U.S. aid. So whether it's the assistance to combat HIV and AIDS, there are these strings around the issue of abstinence only, as a condition for significant amounts of aid to combat that disease. A second issue is that whereas the United Nations has had a internationally recognized program combating AIDS, HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, the Bush administration has refused to give full funding to that UN program and instead was more interested in setting up its own bureaucracy to offer assistance, which seems to run contrary to all of the rhetoric about, that the conservatives often offer about limiting costs. So I think that what the listener has to concern themselves with is not simply the billions and billions that are mentioned, but the character of the money. What percentage does it really represent of U.S. foreign aid? Is it going in the way that it needs to go? For example, when you have the Millennium Challenge account, which was the way that Bush redesigned foreign aid, part of what he did with that was condition the countries receiving aid based on their accepting conditions to redefine their economies to meet the design of the United States.
Well, Bill, one last question very quickly.
Certainly.
The president is about to head off on another swing to the continent. Is this about legacy building? What kind of legacy will he leave behind?
When he went to Africa in the early part of his first administration, I called it a magical mystery tour. This I'd call a retirement cruise. I see no serious attention to the real problems that Africa has, no real attention to the issue of the United States playing a role in repairing the damage that the United States and Europe has done to Africa. And I just think that, yes, this is legacy in the most cynical of manners.
What do you hope, again briefly, that the next administration, Republican or Democrat, could bring to the table?
A discussion about repairing the damage on the continent. Absolutely. Of partnering with the African Union. Of moving away from unilateralism and moving into partnership with African countries to discuss their needs and how and what kind of assistance they need for self-determined development. That's what I would hope and pray for.
Well, Bill, thanks so much.
Anytime. Thank you.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans-Africa Forum. He spoke with us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes. In places like Atlanta, Detroit, and the Brooklyn and Harlem areas of New York, neighborhoods are changing. Nathan McCall has witnessed firsthand the tension caused by gentrification, so he decided to write a book about it. The result is Them, a new novel out from Atria Books. Nathan, welcome.
Thank you.
So why'd you want to write this book? What in particular sparked your imagination?
Well, when I lived in Washington, I began to see the trickle, if you will, the beginnings of gentrification in that area. And when I moved back to Atlanta, I saw more than a trickle. And I read an article in a newspaper about a neighborhood in Atlanta called Kirkwood, where there had been some pretty serious clashes over the issue of gentrification. And so I began thinking about the issue more seriously then and just trying to figure out, you know, what's going on here.
Now, let's move on to the neighborhood that you set your novel up in. It's in Atlanta's old Fourth Ward, the neighborhood where Martin Luther King grew up. Why'd you choose that particular area?
For a number of reasons. One, I spent a lot of time in that neighborhood. And so when I read the article about the clashes in the other neighborhood, I began thinking about the old Fourth Ward because I thought that it would serve as a great symbolic model for the story that I wanted to tell. As you know, Martin Luther King Jr. talked about the notion of the beloved community. And so as I began thinking about this story, I said, wow, what if you had gentrification and serious clashes in this neighborhood, and there was a built-in irony.
Tell me about your protagonist, Barlow Reed.
Barlow Reed is a young black man. On his 40th birthday, he decides that it's time perhaps for him to buy the house that he's been renting for years in the old Fourth Ward. He's a blue-collar worker, and he's from a rural area in Georgia, and his experiences have led him to not trust whites very much. He sees some white city officials come to their farmhouse, and they tell his father that he needs to burn half of the crops that they have grown that year. And basically, the only reason that they want him to burn the crops is that they don't want him to prosper. And so for Barlow, it's, you know, a seminal moment in his life.
What's the situation that Barlow finds himself in with one of his neighbors, Sandy Gilmore?
Well, what happens is that around the time that Barlow decides that he needs to buy the house that he's been renting, he also begins to notice the influx of whites into the neighborhood. And at some point, a white couple moves in, buys the house next door to him, and moves in. The couple's name is Sean and Sandy Gilmore. And so, given Barlow's history, he is naturally distrustful of the couple. But Sandy Gilmore, in particular, is someone who considers herself very progressive, very liberal. And she tries to initiate a relationship, a neighborly relationship with Barlow. And, of course, he's very reluctant. And they begin having these very uneasy conversations over the backyard fence as they try to negotiate matters of race and other issues.
I want to read back a little bit of your work to you. The book is called Them, and this is Sandy, thoughts going through her mind. Other than the family maid, Ethel, she had never really interacted much with them before. She had dealt with them only in passing, in controlled settings where they were the minority. Now, does that really sum up kind of this clash of cultures?
Yes, because, you know, the title Them, I use that title because I wanted a title that was ambivalent. When we refer to them, it's often, you know, one ethnic group referring to the other as them. And so it cuts both ways. The blacks in the neighborhood viewing whites as them, and the whites who are moving into the neighborhoods viewing blacks as them.
You really try to bring us inside the heads of these characters. Barlow and Sandy's husband, who reacts fairly badly to being in the middle of a black neighborhood. And there is without giving anything away, there's some tears and some trouble that occur before this book is over. What did you want to leave? What kind of taste did you want to leave in your readers' mouths? Bitter? Semi-sweet? I mean, are you hopeful at all that we can talk through this issue in the country?
Well, one thing as a writer, I'm aware that people get out of a book what they bring to it. But I knew that in terms of an ending, I did not want to write a book that was a tidy ending, if you will, a happy ending, because that's not often the case as it relates to gentrification. Quite often people are displaced and forgotten about, particularly the poor. And so I wanted to write an ending that was realistic, mildly hopeful, and at the same time, not overly optimistic.
Nathan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nathan McCall has worked as a journalist for The Washington Post. Currently, he teaches in the African American Studies Department at Emory University, and he is the author of the new novel, Them, from Atria Books. On Tuesdays, we listen in on StoryCorps Griot, the project that's recording the stories of African Americans all across the country. In Mississippi, two friends with a long history told their story.
I'm Gustina Atlas, and I'm interviewing a former student of mine.
And my name is Geraldine Nash.
Gustina Atlas, or Miss G as she's known, was Geraldine's high school math teacher more than 30 years ago. Today, their roles have reversed. Geraldine is now a master quilter, and Miss G has become her student. They came to StoryCorps to talk about quilting and their unlikely friendship. Here's Miss G.
Do you remember when I first came here to quilt?
Yes. Do I remember? I walked in, you were sitting in a chair, and I said, oh, Lord, why is she here? I said, this woman was at my school, now she's at my work.
But then your attitude sort of changed toward me. What happened?
When I was in high school, I was always afraid of you. I just perceived you as a mean woman. Then after I got to know you, you was very nice.
What else do you do other than quilt? Do you have a life after quilting?
There is no life after quilting. I goes home, go in the kitchen and fix myself a sandwich or something, and go on back to the sewing machine.
I think over the years, we have really learned quite a bit from each other. When I first came, I didn't know anything about quilting. And then you started telling me and giving me all kind of hints. I remember one thing you say, don't you let everybody quilt on your quilt. And I say, why? And you say, no two people quilt alike. That was the best advice you could have given me, because after I saw other people quilt, you're right. We each have our own style.
One of the things that just really stick to me that I learned from you was not to let somebody else's attitude determine how I'm going to act. And if I had a problem, I would just say, Miss G, you would just give me all this advice. And I would say, okay, I can do that.
Is it anything you want to tell me about myself that you haven't? Do I have any bad habits that you don't like?
I was just always afraid of you, well, but I'm not that anymore.
You have one that I don't like.
Okay.
You have no tact. You say if a person's hair needs combing, you wouldn't say, why don't you go look in the mirror and see what you can do for your hair? You just walk up to go comb your hair. Let me ask you this. Do you think we will always stay in contact with each other?
I hope we will, because I just truly enjoy your company.
Gustina Atlas with her friend Geraldine Nash in Port Gibson, Mississippi. The StoryCorps Griot booth is currently in Montgomery, Alabama. All the Griot Initiative recordings are archived at the Library of Congress. A copy of each interview will also go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. Hear more at nprnewsandnotes.org.
StoryCorps is sponsored by AT&T. Funding for StoryCorps Griot comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
now in 4 minutes or less.
It was back in the mid-80s when Raheem Devon first flexed his singing skills at his elementary school talent show. 8 years ago, Devon took the cash he'd won in another talent contest and used it to put out a series of independent records. Later, he signed with Jive Records, a label that's repped acts from KRS-One to Britney Spears. His new album with the label is Love Behind the Melody, and it's brought him a new level of exposure, including a Grammy nomination for Best Male R&B Vocal Performance for the song Woman. Hey, fellas, if you ain't got one, better search the world to find a woman, strong woman. I spoke with Raheem Devon shortly after a CD signing. He said the line was around the block and the fans were definitely showing him love.
I was a little tardy. I guess that means it went real well, you know, a line wrapped around the building.
How does it make you feel to interact with your fans like that?
I love it. That's what I do. That's what I'm known for, actually. And the support has been overwhelming. I think the more the word spreads, then I'm a meet and greet type of person, you know, after the show and, you know, CD signings and what have you. It's all good. They embrace it. I think the fact that I talk about something of music, you know, message music of value, I think it makes people intrigued and really want to meet me and pick my brain, you know, sometimes.
I'm a loveaholic for you. Plus the fact that my love is dope. You got me hooked.
If you listen to your album, it sounds like you're walking in the footsteps of Curtis Mayfield and the Isley Brothers, Marvin Gaye, as well as people who are more contemporary. Who do you like?
You named them. Curtis, Marvin, Jay-Z, Dave Matthews Band. You know, just to name a few that are inspiring as writers and, you know, prolific writers and artists.
Your father is a musician as well. Did you grow up in an environment where that was important?
Well, I was raised by my mother, but my father was active in my life. So I would spend primarily like my summers with dad and move around with him, as you know, him being a jazz musician and a celloist, and go with him on gigs and stuff like that. My pops has definitely been supportive, and I think I got the sense of independence from him. He put out his own album back in the day, and you know, just kind of very stubborn with it, and did it his way, you know. And I think I've adopted that same behavior. See, life ain't so bad after all.
Now, considering that you put out independent albums as well as label albums, do you ever think, well, I love the music, but I hate the game. I hate the, you know, all of the trappings that go with having to deal with, you know, travel, executives, you know,
well,
this,
love,
that, and the other.
I love the game. I feel like a politician. I feel like I'm a hustler at heart. You know what I mean? Like, I'm passionate about what I do, and you know, I just come from a background of that hustle, so I love the game, you know what I'm saying? I love everything it brings. I love the highs and the lows, you know, and you have good time. When the times are good, they're good, you know. It's not many bad times, you know what I mean? It's what you make it every day. Somebody new is realizing, you know what I mean? You can find it all in me. I'll fill you up and free. If your heart is hungry, you can place your order.
You've got so many things coming up. You're going to be watching how Woman does at the Grammys. I understand you might be doing an after-party performance on Grammy night and BET. So what excites you about this time in your life?
This is all moving. The machine is running, you know? So now this is the moment I've been waiting for. This is the moment that I've been waiting for as a hustler. You know what I mean? I feel like for those that seen American Gangster, I feel like I got the blue magic and it just hit the street. It's the opportunity I've been waiting for. So, you know, I've been properly planning and building the proper team around me. And, you know, now the machine is running, feels like it's running properly. And now we're off to the races. And, of course, you know, you have to seize every moment.
So, Raheem, you're going to be touring with Jill Scott. Are you excited? How'd that come up? What are you going to do?
I'm very excited, you know, with the Grammy nod and all, and us leaving to go on the road February 5th. That's when the tour date starts. And I'm pumped, you know. We're going to actually be in L.A. for the tour and Grammys at the same time. So, it's cool, man. It's a cool experience. It's like the planets are all aligning and everything's coming together. We're going to do a so-so
right now. Oh, Raheem, thanks a lot.
Thank y'all. Thank you. It's Friday night and I
got stacks. The club is crunk, jam-packed. Raheem Devon's new album is called Love Behind the Melody. You can hear songs from the disc at our music site, npr.org/music. He spoke to us from NPR Studios in Washington. Come around three, lose your girlfriends and you can leave me.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.